is for basically two reasons. One is that I have a long-term interest in teaching physics to non-scientists. And for them, the conventional approach is almost always a completely impenetrable thicket. You have to find unfamiliar ways. The more important reason is I myself have a lot of trouble understanding physics most of the time. And unless I can, I think this is true of many of us, unless I can figure it out in my own terms, it doesn't make any sense to me. So I've written a lot of papers talking about things that everybody knows perfectly well. And as you can imagine, I've received a broad spectrum of responses to such papers. However, two of those on the positive side stand out for me in the warmth of the encouragement I've received, in the penetration of the constructive criticism that I received with the encouragement, and in the high regard I have for these readers, independent of what they had to say to me about my own work. The first person is the late Ed Purcell, and the second is the unlate Abner Shimoni, who is still with us and still criticizing in his wonderful way. So I know that Abner won't mind if I revisit a subject that is 98 years old. And since this conference is in honor of Abner, the rest of you are just going to have to put up with it. So, I changed the title slightly. It's now Plane Geometry. That looks very dim from this angle. Can you actually read it? Good. I see, and I can't read it because of the perspective, but I can see it from down here. Good. The title is Plane Geometry in Flat Space-Time. And the idea is to try to construct Minkowski space-time diagrams directly from Einstein's two postulates using an absolute minimum of formal analysis. And this approach, I would say, is to the conventional approach as Euclid is to Descartes in geometry. I found to my surprise that in the course of doing this and trying to make things as simple as possible for these non-scientist students, I was actually led to certain concepts that I'd never run across before. And I tried them out on various relativist friends, and they didn't seem to know about them either. So the thing to watch for, the point to wake up, is when I get to something that I'll call light rectangles. And that's mainly what I'd like to talk about, light rectangles and their uses. So let's begin with Einstein's two postulates. Here they are. One of the things I learned from Purcell is you have to be very careful of which translation of Einstein's postulates you use. I once sent him a paper and he said, "Where did you get that terrible translation?" So since then, I've always quoted them with the German. The German is essential because the translations are my own translations and my knowledge of German is limited to Schubert, Lieder, and Richard Strauss operas. I won't read them, they're very well known to you, but one of the things I like about the second postulate is when he introduces it, he says it's only apparently incompatible with the first. We'll come back to that in a little while. In preparing the talk for this particular meeting, I found that there was a muse who was hovering over me. The muse, coincidentally, was named Abner Shimoni. And one of the things the muse said at a certain point was, wait a minute, that goes beyond Einstein's two postulates. And I thought, good Lord, he's right, there's a third postulate that I need to get anywhere. And then a dim memory flickered on, and I realized that Einstein had actually stated the third postulate in the 1905 paper, not as a postulate, but here it is. If a clock at A runs synchronously with clocks at B and C, then the clocks at B and C also run synchronously relative to each other, which you can probably get from the other two postulates in one spatial dimension, but if you have more than one spatial dimension, it seems to me this is definitely an independent assumption, and I certainly need it for this development, and I thank my imaginary Abner for calling this to my attention. I'll use it in the form, if an event A is simultaneous with an event B and event C, then events B and C are also simultaneous. So you can group simultaneous events into equivalence classes. And I won't call it a separate postulate, but the same is true for events that happen in the same place. And by an event, of course, we mean something that happens in a definite place and a definite time, a point in space-time. And as Einstein also says in a footnote in the paper, this, of course, represents an idealization. It seems to me what an event actually is an element of our experience whose spatial and temporal extent it's okay to consider as insignificant. And therefore, you can view it as a point. And here are some possible events that Alice might observe. The only connection with quantum information theory here is the presence of Alice and her friends. So those are some events. You can read these things, right? I don't have to. You can read it even in the back. Wow, what a system. Okay, so Alice, and then now she's going to be talking about events along a long straight railroad track. And she, first of all, just makes marks in a piece of paper for the events. But she has the freedom of where to put these marks on the piece of paper, so she can start organizing. And the first thing she does is she organizes them by time, using Einstein's third postulate. She can place simultaneous events into a single group, and she chooses to put them all on a single straight line. And I'm going to call these straight lines, lines of constant time, equitemps. I would have preferred isochrones. Somehow Greek seems much more elegant than Latin. But I did a Google on isochrone and got 40,000 hits. It's a standard term in radioactive dating and dendrochronology. You do a Google on equitemps, however, and all you find are certain kinds of ovens and heaters in small numbers. So equitemp it is. And Alice adopts the ordinary convention of mapmakers, namely that the distance on the page between equitemps associated with different times should be proportional to the difference in times that she assigns to those events. Okay, now, she still has the freedom to slide events along equitemps. And she takes advantage of that freedom to further organize the events by location. Events in the same place lie in the same straight line, and those lines we'll call equilokes. Here the Greek is clearly impossible because the Greek would be isotop, which is precisely German for isotope. So we have no choice. We have to go with Latin. Equitemps and equilogues must be parallel, incidentally, because if two equilogues intersected, their point of intersection would be associated with an event that happened in two different places, but by definition, an event happens at a single place. Same for equitopes. The two can't be parallel because they have to intersect in a unique point, which is the event that happens at that place in that time, but otherwise their orientation is arbitrary. Okay, the next thing Alice does is she redefines the foot. In this country, I have to explain that the foot is an archaic unit of distance still used in certain backward countries. But it's my hope that that and other primitive practices will soon stop. And at that point, I confidently predict that within 50 years, the foot will be redefined to be not 0.3048 meters, but just a tiny shade under 0.3 meters. It will be defined to be about 1.5% shorter. And that is very nice because then the speed of light, independent of the speed of the source, will be just 1 foot per nanosecond. So we will use foot in that sense. Foot is a light nanosecond. And so does Alice. So here's what we have so far. Alice has equilogues, equitemps. They make some angle theta with each other. The distance between equitemps separated, describing events separated by a nanosecond, and equilogues separated, describing events separated by a foot is her scale factor lambda. Centimeters of diagram per foot or per nanosecond. And then, of course, it's conventional to orient the diagram as described so that equilogues are more vertical than horizontal, equitemps are more horizontal than vertical, and time advances as you go toward the top of the figure. Okay, there's also an alternative scale factor, mu, which plays a very important role, and this is the reason why Alice does not make the obvious choice of 90 degrees for this angle capital theta. Mu is the distance along an equilogue of two events a nanosecond apart. Does this actually work if I point like this? It does, or the distance along an equitemp of two events 1 foot apart. And Alice's diagrams are now entirely characterized by two independent parameters, any two of lambda, mu, and theta. There's also a very useful concept, which is the unit rhombus, bounded by equilogues and equitemps, separated by 1 foot and one nanosecond, and its areas, as evident from this diagram, is just the product of the two scale factors. Which, although I don't mention this to my non-scientists, can also be written as mu squared sine capital theta. Occasionally, things that are too complicated for my non-scientists, like trigonometry, will appear in this presentation. Okay, now, one of the things Alice wants to describe are photon trajectories, which are all the events in the history of something that moves at a speed of 1 foot per nanosecond. And therefore, they connect opposite diagonals of the unit rhombus, and as a result, as is evident if you rotate the figure that way, photon trajectories associated with photons moving in opposite directions cross at 90 degrees, and they bisect the angle, either this angle down here, capital theta. Something's wrong? What's wrong? What? I turned it on purpose, because I wanted to make the symmetry of the rhombus obvious. They cross at right angles, and they bisect the angles of the vertices. So, okay, that's Alice's diagram. two independent parameters, photon trajectories crossing at 90 degrees and bisecting the angles between equilokes and equitemps. Now, Bob comes along. He's interested in the same events. So he could make his own diagram. But Alice already has these points on a piece of paper representing events. And therefore, Bob would like to save paper and use Alice's events and impose on them his own equilokes and equitemps. And Bob moves at velocity v with respect to Alice, and we're interested in knowing what Bob's equilokes and equitemps look like. And it turns out, of course, that his equilokes are easy. Bob's equiloke is the space-time trajectory of something that moves with constant speed, vba, with respect to Alice. And therefore, Bob's equiloke is certainly a straight line. And here's the rule for its relation to Alice's equilokes and equitemps. Bob goes mu a times h nanoseconds. Bob goes mu a times g feet, where mu a is Alice's scale factor. And therefore, the velocity of Bob with respect to Alice is just the ratio of this length to this length. So that's Bob's equiloke. Now, so far, only Einstein's third postulate has come in. No use whatsoever of the first and second postulate. They come in, of course, when we ask what Bob's equitemps look like. And for that, we do the famous Einstein train experiment. That is, we put Bob on a train moving with velocity v with respect to Alice, and Bob is in the middle of the train, and a flash of light goes off. Two photons start in the center of the train, move to the two end because they start in the middle, and because the speed of light is, Bob is entitled to assume that the speed of light is independent of the speed of the source. Anyway, the speed of the source is zero in his frame. They arrive at the end at the same time, according to Bob. And that determines two simultaneous events at the end of the train. And from that, you can deduce that Bob's equitemps are also straight lines. I put Bob in blue here. And here's the way this all looks in Alice's diagram. Here is the equiloke of the rear of the train, the middle of the train, the front of the train. Light flashes in the middle, arrives at the two ends. So these two events are simultaneous according to Bob. And then there was a wall in the development of this subject where I then had this much of the figure and had to appeal to the theorem that a triangle described in a semicircle is a right triangle, and, you know, various things like that. And then suddenly occurred to me that was kind of heavy weather for my kids, that you shouldn't stop there. You should let the photons be reflected back to the middle of the train again, where they arrive here. And now you have a rectangle. And again, turning the figure the way Shimon does not like, by the symmetry of the rectangle, you immediately see that Bob's equitemp makes the same angle with the 45-degree photon line, with the photon line, as his equiloke makes with the photon line. Or if you want, his his equitemp bisects, I've said everything I want to say. One has now determined that Bob's equilokes and equitemps are symmetrically displaced about Alice's equilokes and equitemps. So here's the situation up till now. And notice that it's completely symmetric between Alice and Bob. This, it seems to me, instantly makes clear why Einstein's second postulate is only apparently in conflict with its first, because you cannot tell now who made the original diagram and who tried to impose on it their own equilokes and equitemps. It's exactly the same, no matter who you describe as the originator of the diagram and who you describe as the one who imposed their own equilokes and equitemps. Now, the one remaining feature we need is the relation of Bob's scale factor to Alice's. But I point out, before we do that, there is one quantitative thing one can say even without scale factors, and that is the quantitative statement of the relativity of simultaneity, which follows directly from the fact that everything you can say about equilokes turns into things you can say about equitemps when you reflect in a 45 in a photon line, because they're symmetrically disposed about the photon line. That is, suppose Bob says two events, P and R, happen at the same place, so they're on a Bob equiloke. Then Alice says, no, they're not, in a time mu a g, in a time mu a h, their position is changed. The position is changed by mu a g. And since the ratio of g to h is just vba, Alice concludes that the distance between the events is v times the time between them, which is perfectly banal. We reflect that in the 45-degree line, and we get the same statement about equilokes. Bob says that P and Q are at the same time, and Alice says, no, they're not. The time between them, the number of nanoseconds that separate them, is just v in feet per nanosecond times the number of feet that separate them. So one gets that out without the scale factor, which incidentally is the way the quantitative relativity of simultaneity ought to be stated. It's amazing how many people will state it with a factor of the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared in it, which brings in scale factors where you don't need scale factors. In fact, a reader of the manuscript of my new relativity book insisted that I had to be wrong, that this couldn't be right. There must be a factor of the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. He was wrong. There doesn't. So, Now we come to the relation between their scale factors. For that, we need a little more terminology. One piece of terminology is familiar. Two events are said to be time-like separated if they lie on somebody's equiloke. Alice, Bob, Carol, Dick, Edward. They're said to be space-like separated if they lie on somebody's equitemp. And they're said to be light-like separated if they lie on a photon trajectory. Unfamiliar terminology. Very useful term. We've seen one example of it already in the Einstein train experiment, light rectangles. Now you can wake up. The light rectangle. Two events determine a light rectangle of photon lines going through the event. Here's a light rectangle for two time-like separated events. Here's a light rectangle for two space-like separated events. For the time-like separated events, incidentally, the meaning of the light rectangle is all events which can be in causal communion with both of these events. It doesn't seem to have any meaning that I can figure out for space-like separated events, but it's just as useful. And we'll be using them for both. So, light rectangles. We'll also talk about the unit light rectangle, which is associated with two events on Alice's equiloke that are 1 nanosecond apart, and therefore the length of its diagonal is Alice's scale factor mu. And we'll also need the area of Alice's unit light rectangle, which you can get by noting that the area of a light rectangle is half the area of the unit rhombus, since you can cut it up into two triangles, and then four of those triangles make a unit rhombus, and the area of the unit rhombus is lambda times mu, the product of Alice's two scale factors. So the area of Alice's unit rectangle is 1/2 lambda mu. Okay, with all that under your belts, we come to the relation between Alice's and Bob's scale factors, and that comes out of another Gedanken experiment that also exploits the constancy of the velocity of light and the principle of relativity. And this Gedanken experiment is simply a demonstration that because of the principle of relativity and the constancy of the velocity of light, the Doppler effect must be reciprocal. That is, if Alice and Bob start in the same place, they're each carrying a clock, they set their clocks to zero, and then they go apart, and each watches the clock of the other, when Bob's clock gets to capital T and he looks at Alice's clock, so he receives light that comes from Alice's clock, when his clock reads capital T, he sees Alice's clock reading little t. Principle of relativity and the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light require that the same must be true of Alice. When her clock reads capital T, she sees Bob's clock over here reading little t. And that sets the scale factor, right? Because now this is the length of Alice's equitemp associated with a time capital T, and this is the length of Bob's. So the ratio of their scale factors, mu b and mu a, is the ratio of this length to this length. And at an early stage of this development, I then did trigonometry and found out what it all was, until it suddenly occurred to me, again, sort of driven by the fact that one wants to say simple with these kids, that you don't need any of that. What you do is you complete these two photon lines into light rectangles. There's going to be one light rectangle that has Alice's clock reading little t and Alice's clock reading zero, and there's going to be another one, sorry, capital T and zero, and another one that has Bob's clock reading capital T and Bob's clock reading zero. So now I'm just going to add those rectangles. Otherwise, the figure will be the same. So keep your eye on that figure, and here it is. So we've completed the photon lines to light rectangles. And now, so Bob's light rectangle has a big side, big B, and a little side, little b, and Alice's has a big side, big A, and a little side, little a. And notice that since these lengths on their equilokes are proportional to the times, the ratio of big B to big A is just the ratio of big T, of Bob's big T to Bob's little t. There it is. And similarly, the ratio of little b to little a is the ratio of Alice's little t to Alice's big T. But that ratio, in fact, the numbers themselves are the same for both Bob and Alice. And therefore, the product of this with this must be 1, which says that little b times big B is little a times big A, which says that the rule is that the area of their light rectangles must be the same. So scale factors are determined by the rule of equal areas for light rectangles on equilokes associated with events the same time apart. And the next picture I will show you is this picture with Alice and Bob simply slid apart from each other to make it a little clearer what we've concluded. So here we are. That's the rule. Now, the area of a light rectangle is 1/2 the product of their scale factors, and therefore we can conclude that the product of the scale factors is the same for everybody. Fine. Now, what can one do with that? Well, first remark to make is the meaning of the area of the light rank rectangle for any pair of events. Any time-like separated events are on somebody's equiloke. If they're on Carroll's equiloke, so here's Carroll's scale factor mu c, c for Carroll, not the speed of light, and here are the two events. They're time t apart, and what we've just seen is that the area of this light rectangle, well, it's scaled up from the area when t is 1 by just the factor of t squared. And by reflection symmetry in the photon line, if the two events are space-like separated, the area of the equiloke, of the equitemp, of the right, of the light rectangle associated with the equitemp is scaled up from omega naught by the square of the distance between them in the in Carroll's frame, which is the frame in which they happen in the same place. So one concludes that for time-like separated events, the area of light rectangle associated with two events in units of omega naught, the universal area of unit right rectangles, is just the square of the time between the events in the frame in which they happen at the same place. And for space-like separated events, omega over omega naught is the square of the distance between the events in a frame in which they happen at the same time. And that, of course, is just the definition of the squared interval. So one concludes that the area of the light rectangle is simply the interval. One has a geometric interpretation of the squared interval between two events, just the area in units of 1/2 lambda mu, which is frame independent in the diagram. Now, what about the other definition of the interval? Namely, it's I squared is the square of the time minus the square of the distance. Well, a nice way to see the connection is to use this. It turns out the connection is more simply seen if you replace light rectangles. I mean, you can do it with light rectangles, but it's more transparent if you replace light rectangles by the rhombus determined by the two events, which I remind you has twice the area of the light rectangle. So, in terms of rhombi, here we are. Suppose here are the events P and Q. Alice imposes equilokes and equitemps on the diagram. And the area, the interval between, well, sorry, the interval between the two events, P and Q, is proportional to the area of this rhombus. The interval between these two events, which is just the square of the distance between them in Alice's frame, is proportional to the area of this rhombus, and the time between P and Q is proportional to the area of this rhombus. So what we have to show is that the area of this rhombus is the area of this one minus the area of that one. And if that's not obvious, look at this figure, which begins by replacing that one. So here we go. So what I'm going to do is cut apart all the pieces into three rhombi and a black triangle and make a second copy of the black triangle. Now, on the one hand, I can put together these two rhombi and two black triangles to get this quadrilateral. On the other hand, I can put together this big rhombus and two black triangles to get this quadrilateral. And you can easily convince yourself that those two quadrilaterals are identical, are congruent, I guess, is the technical term one would use. And therefore, this area equals this area plus this area. Or this area minus this area equals that area. So that's how you get the conventional definition. Well, the alternative definition, the frame independent definition of the interval. Now, there's actually an application of this in three dimensions. Namely, there's a wonderful way to measure the interval between two events using only light signals and a single clock. But for a long time, the only place I could ever find this way of doing it was in Bob Garrosh's absolutely wonderful book, General Relativity from A to B. And I asked Bob whether he had made that up all by himself or whether he had got it somewhere else, and he said he didn't remember, which I'm deeply sympathetic with since I can never remember anything. But just last week, I managed to trace it back to a Princeton undergraduate thesis in 1959 by one Robert Marski, who, according to Google, is now at the University of Arizona. And I learned about this from a 1964 paper by, obviously, Marski and Wheeler, which in a footnote attributes it to Marski's undergraduate thesis. I'd be interested in knowing if I have the feeling it must go back further than that. It seems to me it's absolutely basic in getting general relativity off the ground. And I can't find it in any general relativity texts at all. But here's the idea. It reads atrociously. Right, you have two events, P and Q. Alice moves uniformly with her single clock. Alice and her clock are both present at P. Bob's present at Q. When P happens, Alice's clock reads T naught. When Q happens, Bob sees Alice's clock reading T1. And when Alice sees Q happening, her clock reads T2. The mind trembles at all this. And then I squared PQ, the inter-squared interval is the geometric mean of two of these time differences. In the diagram, it's much clearer what's going on. I'll just show it to you for time-like separated events. So here's the event P, here's the event Q. Alice is present at the event P and her clock reads T naught. When Q happens, Bob looks at Alice's clock and sees it reading T1. And Alice sees event Q happening. When Alice sees event Q happening, her clock reads T2. Now, look, the squared interval between P and Q is the area of this rectangle, proportional to. T squared is proportional to the area of this rectangle. T2 minus T naught squared is proportional to the area of this rectangle, and T1 minus T naught squared is proportional to the area of this rectangle. But the PQ light rectangle is reduced from this big rectangle by this factor F, the amount by which the little TT light rectangle is scaled down from the big TT one. And the area of the little rectangle is reduced from the PQ light rectangle also by the factor F. And therefore, if you cross-multiply, the factor F drops out, and you get that the area of this rectangle is just the geometric mean of this area and this area, but the squared intervals are proportional to the areas. And there you are. So I like that. I like that invariant definition, that invariant argument that shows why this trick works for getting the interval. I should say, by the way, that I've now described to you 3 weeks of this course and at least two homework assignments, just in case you think I'm insane trying to teach this stuff to non-scientists. All right, in the 5 minutes that remain to me, thanks to the organizers getting off the track, I thought I would show you one more thing, which is the question of when, I mean, the nice thing about the example I just showed you is, although it happens in three dimensions, all that's relevant is one line and one point, right? Alice's trajectory and the event Q, and a line and a point determine a plane. So plane diagrams are fine. But suppose one has some intrinsically higher dimensional things, what can we do? Well, Alice can now start stacking her diagrams, right, in the direction perpendicular to the screen. Coming out of the screen, you can see many such diagrams. And what we'd like, and the question is, how far out from the screen is a new slice of now, say, three-dimensional space-time going to be associated with events that are 1 foot apart in the perpendicular direction? And that's a new scale factor, sigma. So what is sigma? Well, one wants to determine sigma in such a way that the diagrams of people who are not going parallel to Alice, who are going at some angle to the railroad tracks, will also have the same properties as Alice's and Bob's diagrams when Alice and Bob are going along the railroad tracks. And in particular, that means for them too, photon lines, lines associated with photons going in opposite directions should meet in right angles. And that means that this photon trajectory for all the photons going through this point P should expand into a right circular cone, the light cone. So, now a truly monstrous diagram where I am now using color for the third dimension. So, here's the original diagram in plane diagram in red. Here's one displaced, the blue thing, out of the screen so that events S, T, and U are just P, Q, and R displaced out of the screen by a distance sigma. This faint golden line that you probably can't see is the light cone projected. And then purple lines are lines that are in neither plane. They're going from one plane to the other. And here's a second photon that starts at P and goes out to the event U. Now, Alice's equitemp has expanded into an equitemporal plane, so that the photon, when it arrives at event U, 1 nanosecond has elapsed. Its motion is entirely in the perpendicular direction, since this is a line of Alice equilokes. And therefore, the distance it's gone is just sigma, since sigma is the separation of the diagram associated with 1 foot. So, and now one therefore wants this point to be the same distance from the axis here as Q is, and one knows what these lengths are in terms of Alice's scale factor. You apply the Pythagorean theorem, do a little trigonometry, and you get that sigma is the geometric mean of Alice's two scale factors, mu and lambda. Now, mu, sigma, mu and lambda, the product mu lambda is invariant. And therefore, I can conclude, having boasted at the start of my obsession with saying things as clearly as possible, with the claim that I have showed you the most complicated derivation that exists of y prime equals y, z prime equals z. But there it is. Fortunately, I have no time for the philosophical remarks. And I'll conclude by showing you references. Enormously expanded version of this with everything except the extension to additional spatial dimensions you can find in my new book. An earlier version appeared in the commemorative issue of Annalen der Physik, and I first published it, this is important, in 1998 in the American Journal of Physics. It's important because Dieter Brill and Ted Jacobson put something very nice because it was very similar, on the archive in 2004, and we got into a friendly correspondence. And I learned from them that there was really, both of us had been scooped to some degree in 1913, unsurprisingly, by a huge paper in a journal that is incredibly difficult to get at and read. But more importantly, I learned from them about the website of Dirk Eckhard Liebscher, where you can see this beautiful movie of this space-time Pythagorean theorem, where the equivalent sets of rhombuses continuously deform from where the t squared minus you know what I mean. The I squared and the x squared ones continuously deform into the t squared one, and a similar set of figures for the ordinary Pythagorean theorem. Liebscher has also written a book, which was only available in German until last year. It's now come out by published by Wiley, and I just got a copy on Friday. It looks like a terrific book, which I highly recommend. And with that, I'll end. I ran over 2 minutes, but not as bad as the organizers.